Okay, let's continue.
So, reflections of political developments in different countries form a different criminology, right? First, the differences between Europe on the one hand, America on the other hand, now within Europe. But you look out of a Western mindset, then from a non-Western perspective, it's all the same. Remember what we discussed yesterday, that the closer you look on a lower empirical level, the more the differences strike you, and the more distance you take, the more the similarities strike you. Now, with all the differences we have discussed, well, we simply have to see that you never feel more European than when you are outside of Europe, and you do not feel more Western and even more, I hate to say, but even more American than when you're outside of the Western world. You see that we have also a lot in common with our friends in North America. For people outside of the Western Hemisphere, both Europe and the United States are very affluent, very rich, industrialized societies. We are democracies, civil liberties are guaranteed to a certain extent. See, so there is this idea, well, this is the place to live. It's not coincidental that refugees come mainly to Western Europe and to North America. You hardly see ever refugees say, well, I want to apply for political asylum in Sudan. That's not the case, and it's not coincidental that that's not the case, because life is hard. But it's a kind of envy that we have better lives than they, which they see all the time on the television. There you see the relevance of Abu Dhabi again. Even when you live in a hut in a shanty town, you mostly have a television and you watch the rich and famous from all over the world. So you know exactly how life, even when your own life is very limited in possibilities, you know exactly how people in the West live, because you have television, mostly. The thesis of Abu Dhabi and most anthropologists today is that people from third world countries know exactly how life in the West is, but people from the West have no clue how life in the third world is. So we can less imagine how it is to live in a third world country than people from third world countries can imagine how it is to live here. Hence, they want to come here. But it's not only that they have a very positive view of the West. If you read critics, particularly from India, they're now pretty severe critics. So, well, they have all been imperialist countries. Traditionally, many Western countries have had colonies and treated the colonies as if it were their property. Spain, mostly in Latin America, the last Spanish colony was Cuba, I think, lost pretty long ago. I don't think Spain has... Well, Ceuta and Melilla, of course. Yes. Ceuta and Melilla. Ceuta and Melilla. Well, England, India, Pakistan, the whole Commonwealth, in fact, even Canada, as the head of state, as the Queen of England, still. Holland, Indonesia, Suriname, Antilles. Holland is also, for a very small country, had quite a number of colonies. Belgium, the Congo, Rwanda, France, Algeria, Morocco, Tunisia, Italy, Ethiopia, Somalia. So we were colonizers, all of us, and treated parts of the world as our property. A lot of our richness comes from the colonies, the gold from Latin America, the spices from Indonesia, the opium. Holland was a very well-known opium trader in the, till the 19th century, all the opium from Java. So a lot of our richness comes from our empire. America, as a young country, has not had an empire in the traditional European sense of the word, but of course America has other ways of colonization. It's a more economic colonization, and it's a more military colonization, particularly in Latin America. And the war in Iraq, is an oil war, let's face it. I mean, it has never been demonstrated that the regime of Saddam Hussein is a pretty nasty regime, that's obvious, but it had nothing to do with the attacks of 9/11. It was to safeguard, let's say, oil supply. The war in Afghanistan has as much to do with Osama bin Laden as it has with the heroin. The fact that 80% of the heroin comes from the from Afghanistan. Hence, the United States is not a colonizing, has never been a colonizing country in the exact sense of the word, but in another sense, yes. And people outside of that hemisphere, if you have been at the other side, you do see us, Spanish, Dutch, Americans, as oppressors. Definitely, you bet. We are also mega consumers. The well-known fact that 20% of the world population consumes 80% of all the natural sources. Imagine, it has been calculated that we need 5 globes if India and China want to have the same level of consumption as we in West have. It's simply impossible. But there is very few movement to consume less in the Western part of the world. Whereas at the same time, China and India are moving towards high consumption levels at the same time. So things, if you look at new world problems, you can already predict oil will remain a big thing, water will become an increasingly important factor. And I don't know if you are familiar with the work of Edward Said, the book Orientalism. Edward Said, also anthropologist from Egyptian origin, has argued that the colonization does not have an economic effect, but also a mental effect. The East has, in Western eyes, always been mythicized. Yeah? It's the Arabian, the Lords of Arabia. It's the mysterious East. It's always the mystery. Africa is also the dark, it's the cannibals, it's the primitive man, you know. These kind of Western ideas, because they came in such fine suits and with all their goods and their wealth, and so the people who were colonized looked up to them. And Edward Said's point is the Western perspective of the East has also led to a kind of feeling of inferiority of people who were colonized. In many, let's say, or to put it very simply, many black people think indeed that they are less intelligent than white people. Many Middle East people think they are indeed not as capable of organizing things so well as in the West. So then you also have as a consequence a kind of moral feeling, a feeling of moral superiority from the Western side, which is very much hated. You see, it's still very visible in if people go on holiday, for example. If you are a German and you go to Mallorca, or an Englishman, you think you're better than the Spanish. If a Spanish looks at a Latin American, the Spanish thinks he's always better than the Latin American. And we always have our cabezas de turco. Yeah. We all all have our hierarchies in our thinking. And also people who are at the other side have that hierarchy very clear in their mind, is the point Said tries to make. So, despite all the differences from the outside perspective, all the same, it's all the West, it's all Yankees. In Afghanistan, don't think that the people who are there, okay, we will not put a bomb here because it's not American troops, it's Spanish troops. It's all the same. It's all Al-Otan. It's all now. As I explained already yesterday, is that in many theories, Western theories, there are two main paradigms very dominant, which is the paradigm of modernization and the paradigm of civilization. We expect implicitly in the back of our mind that all kinds of primitive countries, in inverted comma, will follow the same path towards democracy, towards modernization. But if you look at literature from that countries, non-Western countries, it's a mistake to think. If you look at China, everybody would say, well, China's developing in a capitalist direction now, so they will leave communism. Not at all. They stick to the communism, but apply it in a very capitalist way with open market, etc. And the Chinese move back to Confucius. So it's not true that they will follow, it's not probable, let's put it that way, I don't have a crystal ball either, but it's not probable that they will follow the lines of modernization and civilization as we did and as the theories of Weber and Durkheim have predicted. It's very unlikely that the same will happen. The tempo is very different. If you look at the level of industrialization in India or in China, it's a very different, what we did in centuries is happening there in decades. But also in the West, the theories of modernization are criticized, of course. Think of the whole word postmodern, suggests that modernity is also a phase that can have an end. It is not taken for granted anymore that progress is intrinsically good. Consume more and more and more and more is simply impossible. It's not either the idea that progress is endless. Up till my parents' generation, probably, or maybe even my own generation, people would expect that the life of their children would be a bit better than of themselves. That process, unfortunately, has come to a stop. It's not true. Even life expectancies are not going up that much. The idea that education for everybody or welfare levels, I mean, your parents have their pension at 65, I presume. You will have to work till you're 70, very probably. Your parents have had a house, could buy a house. You probably can buy a house if you're 50. The whole idea of progress is, particularly now in the economic crisis, hardly anybody believes it in the West either. But in the non-Western world, the idea of modernization and civilization was already questioned, but with the economic crisis, it's also questioned in the West itself, increasingly. Many theories, but I understood from Ignacy that they're not so known in Spanish criminology, which are based on Weber mainly, and Elias, on the other hand, seem to claim that crime will decrease with modernization and civilization. That turns out not to be true either. The thesis of Zygmunt Bauman that the Holocaust has been an extremely modern project because it was carried out in such an industrialized, bureaucratized way, has challenged that. From that side, and the story of Japan, we did follow the process of modernization to Western standards to a large extent. would lead to a lesser crime. It doesn't. Japan is the example of the opposite, that the crime will lead to more modernization, would lead to more crime. It's not true either. Look at the case of Japan, which is a very modernized country, a very industrialized country, and still has very low crime due to cultural phenomena. The network, the patchwork of Japanese society is very tight. People watch it. The informal social control is very, very, very high. It's a very different form of social control that we know, with hierarchies and expectations of people living up to that expectations. So people watch each other much more traditionally. So this idea that modernization and civilization and the implicit, which are implicit in most of our criminological theory, does not hold outside of the Western world, has led a number of scholars, amongst whom Rico Arazino, of whom I spoke over yesterday, to the idea that criminology has to be decolonized from Western biases. Arazino argues that the West African reality cannot be understood with Western theories, because it does not take into account that social control is mainly exercised by the military, that moral leadership, intellectual leadership is absent, the leaders are extremely corrupt because there is no tradition in leadership because of the colonization, because the ruling class have always been British, French, Italians, Dutch, etc. So while you cannot expect people to be occupied with crime or crime control that much, if you look at the living conditions of large groups of the population, beyond every level of possible human existence, below any possible poverty line and the extreme richness. You can see nowhere you can see so many Rolls Royces as in Africa, probably. Maybe in Russia, which also moved from a state-led system to a system of savage capitalism, and where you know also from theories of Marx in Europe, the phase after feudalism is the phase of savage capitalism, where the excesses are the largest, where the rich are extremely rich, also in West Africa. And you can see that the countries are terrorized continuously by very bloody civil wars in the Congo, in Somalia, Rwanda. You can see that. It's about no Western theory is able to explain it, because it takes moral leadership, it takes an accountable police, it takes some level of democracy for granted. And he said, what did modernity bring? Modernity didn't bring much good, was his answer. With the colonizers in the Nigerian case were the British. So there was a, let's say, the Pallava culture. It's not for nothing that most of the restorative justice was based on non-Western forms of dispute settlement. And Akosino argues, we had them in Nigeria as well. Next to very violent practices, there were also very many practices of dispute settlement. Endless palavras oriented at forgiving and reconciliation. Very few prisons. Prison was a Western invention, not a third world invention. And if you look at statistics, Africa countries are still very low imprisonment rates. It doesn't say much, because if you're very poor, you don't have the money to construct prisons either, because street prisons are extremely important, are extremely expensive. But nonetheless, prison is something that we brought to the non-Western world. religious pluralism, he points out. If you look at Nigeria today, where he is coming from, endless civil wars between Muslims in the north and Christians in the south. Well, there were always Christians in the south and Muslims in the north, and they lived together pretty well. In the Rwanda case, also, the Hutus and the Tutsis have always lived together, and you and I will not see the difference physically. But it was a typology introduced by the Belgian priests. So we introduced also a lot of problems there, is his argument. So what brought modernity more? First, it was slavery, of course. That was the first thing that modernity brought. Art theft. Most of the art was stolen and brought to our museums. Elimination of traditional leadership, replacement of colonial rule, leaving after the process of colonization countries without tradition of leadership, which also caused a lot of extra problems. Edward Said's argument we dealt with, and the exploitation of mineral resources, which is still the case. Many non-Western countries are producing countries of minerals that we need. Oil being the most dominant. Coltan, the whole war in the Congo, between, and particularly the area between Rwanda, Burundi, and Congo, is one of the very few areas for coltan. Coltan is what we all is the material you need for the mobile phones, for example, and for computers. Right? It's a very expensive mineral, and it's mainly found there. So to have a very rich soil with a lot of minerals is not always a blessing, because it always leads to war. And this is happening in many of these countries. In Nigeria, you don't know, you're too young for that, but that Shell has driven out the Ogoni, which is a whole population. They were for centuries living there. Their forefathers were buried there. Shell simply expelled them from their own soil because there was oil, in league with the Nigerian government. And the social movements were simply killed by, not by Shell, but by the Nigerian government. Diamonds, the same story, Sierra Leone, the wars in Sierra Leone and in Liberia are wars over diamonds. Diamonds were dug by young kids mainly and are used to finance the warlords. Gold, particularly in Latin America but also in Southern Africa, the same story. It's exploited by Western companies, leaving the shit, so to say, to the countries and the environmental devastation to the global communities. And we treat it also as a waste dump. Also, a topical example, which you may have heard of, which was a scandal because it was a Dutch company. It was a ship with toxic waste. Called Robacoana, went to the port of Amsterdam with very toxic waste. It was pumped out of the ship in order to be refinated. But the Amsterdam Port Authorities argued, well, it will cost you so much. The ship owners argued, that's too much. The ship was pumped back again into the ship. The ship sailed out. The Amsterdam Port Authorities should never have given permission to have it sail out with that stuff, because what they did is they sailed to Ivory Coast and simply dumped it on the coast. Very toxic stuff, causing serious illnesses for thousands and thousands and thousands of people. So we, the West, have some debt to the third world. We use it as a waste dump, we use it as our digging tom for things we need. So Agostino is quite militant. He's quite a militant person, but he does it quite convincingly, that we have something, that some debt to pay to non-Western countries. If you look at Latin America, you do not see this kind of hatred towards the colonizer. First the colonizing Spain. Spain has lost their colonies much earlier than France, Holland, England. I mean, we still have colonies. The Antillas is still a colony of Holland. But most of the colonies, well, the North African countries were independent in the 1950s. India also in the late 40s. So this is the second half of the 20th century. Spain is 150 years earlier that they lost their colonies. And you see a big difference with Africa is that they're permanent settlers. Particularly if you look at a country like Argentina, it's very hard to find any indigenous person. Some of the Latin American countries are completely Europeanized or mixed with indigenous people and Europeans and slaves like Brazil. So this is again a very, very different story. In Africa there are no real settlers, and if they were there, like in Rhodesia, present-day Zimbabwe, they were simply kicked out after the independence. The Dutch also were simply kicked out of Indonesia in the 1950s. Not in Latin America. The Spanish settlers have always remained there, and the Italians and the slaves and the Portuguese. You also see that Latin America has not always been poor. And again, if you look at now the state, particularly of Brazil, Brazil is doing quite a bit better than Spain at the moment, economically. But it is an interesting story that there is hardly any African country which had, let's say, a period of prosperity after colonization. But Latin America did. Argentina was the fifth richest country on earth in the 1950s still. And it got bankrupt in 2000. So you can see how quickly things can change. Now again it's much better, but this makes a very, very, very different culture and a very different relation to Europe. Particularly Argentinians consider themselves Europeans and are proud of their European roots. So the argument is not so much that we should not adopt European criminological theories. They do. They use a lot of European criminology. The problem in Latin America is different. The empire of evil is up north in Latin America. Latin Americans know very well, so they have more, let's say, a resistance against American criminology than against European criminology, because they feel much closer to Europeans than they do to North Americans. First, of course, Americans are always afraid of communism. Wherever they fear communists will pop up, they will support everybody who is against communists. You can see it in Afghanistan, when the Russians invaded. That was when America started to support the Mujahideen. America supported, in fact, the emergence of Taliban. In Greece, when Greece was turning communist, they supported the colonels in their authoritarian regime. So, also Vietnam, of course, the same story. Fear of communism, occupation, leaving again. This is the eternal story of America's foreign policy.
I'm totally with Spain and our own.
Yeah, of course. Spain is the very same story. And Latin Americans have not forgotten, of course, that the CIA has supported Pinochet, Videla, Struzan, Batista, etc., etc., etc. Don't forget, Cuba is now isolated, but it is, let's say, I'm not a big fan of Fidel Castro, to be sure, but I mean, the struggle of Castro was against the dictatorship that was installed by the Americans. Operation Condor, it goes even further. In 1975, most of the secret services of Argentina, Brazil, Chile, Paraguay, and Uruguay were trained even by the CIA. And the CIA many of these subversive elements and helped, in fact, the secret services of the military regimes there. Slightly later, when Nicaragua turned to the left, and El Salvador was also probably falling to the left side, it was immediately clear that America would support the counter-revolutionaries. Isolation policy towards Cuba and the neocolonization of Colombia, which is, of course, the main provider of cocaine. Same story as Afghanistan. Cocaine has to be blocked. Hence, you have to be present in Colombia. And most of the Colombian presidents have been very loyal to America. So,
Operation Condor, that maybe they don't know what is Operation Condor. Do you know?
No.
Operation Condor?
You know more.
Okay. No, there is a famous book of Argentinian criminologist which explains very well the
Operation
Condor and what was
the police
that was
putting
the
police
in
the
crowd.
Sí,
I will. Yeah, absolutely, yes. Operation Condor, también Operación Condor, y es la explicación de cómo la CIA ayudó a crear una policía que se llamaba Latina, que era la policía secreta que luchaba contra, que tenía potestad para luchar contra la Argentina, y que luchaba a todos los países como quería la batería para luchar contra los elementos subversivos, y en la historia de la criminología crítica de la Argentina, la crítica de la Operación Condor es un tipo de importancia, cómo funcionó la Operación Condor, y toda la idea de la seguridad nacional. Es una historia bastante importante en América Latina, todas las apariciones famosas en la Escuela de la Armada son un elemento
de So you see a very paradoxical thing coming up, right? You see in Europe that American criminology has become more popular because of the bankruptcy, the moral bankruptcy of European criminology. You see American criminology being unpopular in Latin America because it is American. And you see European criminology being very influential in Latin America because it is from Europe. And you see in a West African reality that neither the European tradition nor the American tradition is actually quite useful. Seem to be quite useful. You see, in Latin America, Lombrosian perspective is extremely dominant. I was surprised when I first looked at Latin American criminology, how alive Lombroso still was, still in the 60s or 70s. It took quite a lot of time to be removed. But how it was translated there was, in fact, because the division, the sharp divisions between rich and poor were explained to Lombrosian's ideas on survival of the fittest. So it fitted in a way. Also the idea of social defense, the Franz von Liszt idea, fitted in a way to an authoritarian tradition in Latin America. So it was mixed with a political agenda, very much the European legal system combining with US ideas on punishment because the prisons were more looking like American prisons than European. It's nearly great. After the democratization, most of the Latin American countries were democracies again by the mid-80s, and you see a dominant orientation on critical criminology. I would say that in Latin America, critical criminology is a niche maybe, or maybe in one country is more than in another, but if it makes up 25 to 30%, it's a lot. In Latin America, you could say, well, maybe 80-90% of the criminology you find is critical criminology. This is very interesting to see after the democratization. A lot of focus on crimes of the powerful, corruption, human rights violations, etc., etc., etc. Logical after a period of dictatorship. Also logical in a period of dictatorship is the fact that you concentrate more on the rule of law. Very influential was, for example, ideas of Alessandro Baratta on diritto penale minimo, and Luigi Ferraioli, is translated into Spanish as well. Diritto e ragione, diritto e ragione. Very much concentrated on the legal guarantees that criminal law offers against arbitrary state intervention. The traditional, classical Beccaria argument for criminal law also became very dominant. Abolitionism, like my predecessor, Luke Holtzman, has been very influential, also as a strong critic of the state, because it's a rather anarchist perspective. The people in Latin America liked that, because they were fed up with the state. Luigi Ferraioli, Eugenio Savaroni, an Argentinian criminologist from the UBA, University of Buenos Aires, was very much in line with Hulsman. Now, the interesting thing is that abolitionists are very often considered to be the fool on the hill, who has nothing to do with practice. I want to correct this picture. Hulsman has been very active. He was absolutely a complete apparatchik. He knew the bureaucracy very, very well, and has been very influential, for example, in the liberalization of the Dutch drugs legislation, the liberalization of the Dutch vice law and traffic law, and on depenalization. So he has been very influential. Eugenio Savaroni is now, I think he's the president even of the Supreme Court, right? Yeah. I mean, so it doesn't mean that if you have a radical perspective on criminal law that you have no influence. And both Savaroni and Hulsman prove that you can be very influential also with a radical perspective. This is in Latin America today still possible, in Europe not. I would say in Latin America you see the progressive people are ruling now. This is very different from a European situation where we are more in a neoliberal line. And of course, you see in Latin American criminology coming up increasingly, let's say, the other side of the pipeline. The drugs, we are on the consumption side, they are on the production side. More studying the production side. And studies on poverty and on megacities. This is more or less the last slide. You do see with the years that the hatred, if you like, or the distrust in America is decreasing. So you do see now a lot of American stuff coming up, mainly Chicago School and structure function. I think this was it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
También.
Pues la edición a control y dominación en castellano, Máximo Pavarini, siglo XXI en el editorial, sí. Pues el, tiene un epílogo de Roberto Recalli, argentino, que es el sí. autor del libro que mencioné antes sobre Operación Cóndor, y ahí cuenta un poco el desarrollo de la criminología sí. latinoamericana. Y sí.
Pero lo que queda ahí interesante es que al inicio han tomado europeos, pero más en la doctrina más autoritaria, pero después la democratización han elegido autores europeos de nuevo, mientras en Norteamérica, los Estados Unidos, hay una tradición de criminología crítica muy fuerte también, pero no han mirado esto lado, ¿no? Es más por la lengua, creo.
Sí, por cuestiones culturales.
También, la identificación cultural y la lengua, sí.
Sí. De América Latina son sí. europeos.
Sí, sí, sí. Pero lo que es sorprendente que hay también en la criminología crítica norteamericana unos libros exquisitos que son muy críticos sobre la política externa de América. Toma un David Chambers, Bill Chambers, por ejemplo. Describe el CIA, el CIA, se dicen acá creo, el CIA como una organización criminal, ya en 77. Entonces, podían elegir también ejemplos norteamericanos que son muy críticos a su propio Estado, pero no lo han hecho. Es interesante para memorizar.
Pero Vergali, ¿no? Fue exiliado aquí.
Claro, claro. Con
Bustos. Con Bustos lo mismo, Costa del Olmo también.
Sí, también.
Y todos los de aquí
sí, pues, iban para han venido a Europa. Sí.
Todos habéis enseñado los másteres del vino, sí. todos los profesores han enseñado los másteres del vino.
Sí, exacto.
Sí. Yo siempre gusto cosas de tecnología aplicada, pero es difícil.
Sí, Agusino es uno de los pocos. Basura africano, hay un montón, pero no es África. Son blancos también, ¿no? Sí. Suráfrica tiene la ley es holandés todavía, y hablan inglés, y bueno, es un país dominado por... Tiene la tradición europea mucho más que otros países. Pero mira, la educación universitaria en países que mueren de hambre es no la primera prioridad. ¿Ah, sí?
No sé si alguna sobre criminología.
No, no, es que he llegado a la mitad porque estaba haciendo un examen, pero
bueno. ¿Y ha ido bien?
Sí.
Me alegro. Política, ¿no? Política.
No, política.
No, el examen.
¿Cuál examen? No, pero las chicas de
ahí. De antes del bar de tercero.
Ah, sí. Bueno, el resto del curso, porque es un parte, es el inicio de un curso que doy en Rotterdam y toca más a varios crímenes globales, ¿no? A la criminología verde, en la criminología del cyberspace, la criminología de derechos humanos, violaciones de derechos humanos. Continúa así y busco ejemplos para aplicar este modelo teórico y modelo metodológico a varios campos de investigación. Eso es el resto del curso. Pero es un curso de un semestre.
Sí, cuando hablabas de lo de la sede en Nigeria, era una de las cosas que yo había pensado.
Sí, sí, hay un montón. Son desarrollos que se hacen mucho en Holanda, como tú sabes. La criminología verde es un gran tema. Bueno.
Pero esto de la Shell, hubo una sentencia del Tribunal Europeo, ¿no?
Sí,
de
sí.
Derechos Humanos.
Sí.
¿Y cómo acabó esto?
Acabó con el hecho que la Bueno, era sobre la contaminación del delta de Níger, ¿no? Terminó que no era la culpa única de Shell, pero también de la gente que han rompido las pipas de aceite. Y es más, el juego era más, que era más la culpa de la población que de la gente. Sí, de los Ogoni, de Senkarovivo, pero es hace 15 años, creo. No era, la condena era tampoco que era la causada por Shell, pero era causada por las autoridades nigerianas. No, las empresas multinacionales casi nunca son condenadas. Tampoco para violaciones de derechos humanos, ¿eh? Aunque ven muy bien, saben muy bien que estos zapatitos son hechos por chicos de 4 años. No, las empresas escapan. Y la última clase de este curso es sobre gobernanza a nivel global, que no existe. Y cómo las empresas multinacionales usan siempre la legislación fiable, la legislación más débil, para hacer cosas que no podían hacer en su propio país. No es solo que el gasto de sueldos es muy más bajo en otros países, no. Son las reglas también, que admiten mucho más que en España o en Holanda o en Inglaterra o en Estados Unidos.
Ahora no sé si sabes si puedes mandar el tercer hombre más rico del mundo, que es español, ¿no? Y que ahora se dedica a hacer la máquina, sacar la palabra a su madre, pero ha sido titulado todavía, o sea, ha trabajado desde su lado, ¿no?
Sí,
pues,
sí, sí, sí. Bueno, eso es un gran tema también con el tráfico de diamantes, por ejemplo, que son enterrados, no, al revés, desenterrados por esclavos, jovencitos. Sí, es un gran tema, el de la esclavitud no es abolido. Chocolate. Bueno, es un campo de investigación en la criminología que olvidamos muchas veces, pero es importantísimo tener una perspectiva más propia que es el crimen.
Me quiero preguntar, me han dicho una internacional, ¿hay criminólogos que existen en tribunales o Naciones Unidas?
Sí. Sí, las criminólogos, las Estados Unidos, las Naciones Unidas tienen muchos puestos de trabajo para criminólogos. De nuestra universidad trabajan dos, creo, en Naciones Unidas, sí. Sí, sí. Investigador, en general son investigadores. Sí, investigación. Y en los tribunales también investigación. Es en el caso holandés es más probable, porque los tribunales internacionales de Yugoslavia y tal son todos en Holanda. Pero sí hay posiciones. Y hay muchos investigadores de ONGs también. El Soros, Fundación Soros, Open Society Institute, que funda, es también uno de los hombres más ricos del mundo, pero usa su dinero para financiar proyectos de investigación crítica. El más rico del mundo es mexicano.
Sí.
Bueno, de nada.